Thank you, Taylor, and I want to thank the U.S. Institute of Peace also for convening this meeting. It struck me when I got the invitation that I haven't had an invitation to a meeting on African foreign policies for the longest time. It used to be a very hot issue, but I think we've shifted our focus and forgotten that the larger issues we deal with, security issues in Africa, peacekeeping, counterterrorism, so forth, really depend on African foreign policies, and we better know more about it. So I congratulate you on refocusing our attention. I think we've had some very rich presentations to really expose some of the issues. And what I'm going to do is to talk a little bit about what I think is new or not new in the African security agenda, some of the domestic determinants of African foreign policy, and then finally, what are the implications for U.S. policy as we move forward to address African security issues. First, what is new or not new? I think one of the things that we've just assumed but not stated explicitly, and it's important, I think, to state it explicitly, is that new norms are emerging in Africa about intervention. We have to remember that traditionally Africans were the foremost advocates of non-intervention in the internal affairs of states, the foremost advocates of the UN being the only authority to really intervene in the internal affairs of states, and they were a solid block on this. They were very sensitive about guarding sovereignty and not compromising sovereignty for anything. And now, in terms of the research that we've done, it's pretty clear that Africa's way ahead in this debate over humanitarian intervention, in saying informally, incorporating it into the Charter of the African Union, that they prefer that any intervention take place with a UN mandate. But in the event that the UN does not act, that the African Union and African states accept the fact that collectively they have the right to intervene to protect civilians. This is something that was stated formally. The rest of the world hasn't gotten there yet. Other regional organizations haven't said that yet. It's happened in Africa before, in terms of before that was stated in the Charter, going back to when Tanzania invaded Uganda to get rid of Idi Amin. It was illegal, but the world breathed a sigh of relief, and it's been done ever since, and it's important to get the fact that there are norms and it has to be collective. Secondly, I think as Tori pointed out, sub-regional organizations have in fact acted even more than the AU until recently, or the OAS. So in Africa, you have a combination of a continent-wide organization plus sub-regional organizations. The identity is very strong for the sub-regional organizations. Unfortunately, I think what's happened is that if sub-regional organizations do not act, that prevents the AU from acting, and I think the comments on Zimbabwe illustrated that. SADC is totally opposed to intervention, and you're not going to get any AU action if SADC continues to be adamant. Third, interstate wars are on the decline. I'm not saying that you're not going to have one, but ever since the Ethiopian-Eritrea war, you really haven't had an interstate war. Most of the conflict emerges internally, so the human security agenda is front and center. It's a depiction of actual reality. You did have a lot of interstate intervention in the DRC, but that was as a result of an internal collapse. So it was really an extension of a failed state. Next, I think that in terms of the peacekeeping issues, the two giants in the continent still are Nigeria and South Africa in terms of capacity and will to intervene. But in the case of Nigeria, it itself is a weak state, and as Herb pointed out, has had a lot of civil conflict, even though it hasn't been getting a lot of press. If the figure of 80,000 is right, that's really quite a horrendous figure of civil conflict, and it does raise a lot of questions about Nigeria's own capacity to bring peace elsewhere. And South Africa is having a lot of tensions themselves, as David pointed out, not in terms of weakness, but I think in terms of democratization and consolidation of interest groups internally. And finally, something that hasn't changed in Africa, and that is that foreign policy is still basically an elite phenomenon. Civil society doesn't participate much. There isn't much debate in local newspapers from civil society over much of the foreign policy. It's usually decided by the executive or by the military. And so most of the players, decision makers, really are elites. There are a lot of rumors going around in Nigeria on peacekeeping operations that there were ghost soldiers, that that some of the operations really weren't getting home. There was more debate in this country over the behavior of Nigerian troops in Liberia than there was in Nigeria itself. So we have to recognize that this is still an elite phenomenon. I think most of the domestic determinants of African foreign policy have been mentioned, but I just want to list them here just in terms of completeness. Militaries do often reflect their societies, so one of the things we have to look at is not just the competence and professionalism of militaries, but what are the ethnic, regional, and political factions that could generate either good performance or poor performance, and be very aware of that. This has definitely been a problem in Nigeria in the past, and of course, because of the heritage of apartheid, it is an issue in South Africa. HIV/AIDS is a horrendous problem, and I think David is absolutely right that there hasn't been enough attention to this. We're making a lot of plans. I'm not sure that the plans that we're making for training include HIV/AIDS, but we certainly should do that because a lot of the times we'll be training people who by the time they are due to be deployed are too sick to be deployed. We also have to understand that the political nature of the state, I think as Herb was pointing out, is very important. It's important to understand and evaluate civilian control of the military, what kind of security sector reforms have been adopted, if there's transparency and accountability. I think South Africa is way ahead of Nigeria on this score. It's never had a coup d'etat. It's absorbed the former wings of the liberation armies into the national government. And here was a country that had decades of civil conflict, political violence, politically motivated civil conflict, and now you have no real political violence in South Africa, whereas in Nigeria, you have all kinds of multiple causes of violence, politically, ethnic, demographic, and what have you. There's also a history in Africa of using the military for political ends, that is to either use it to repress opponents or to use it to suppress domestic unrest because the police either don't have the capability or the will to do it. There's also a question of corruption, and Herb rightly mentioned the phenomenon of bunkering, which is not only the smuggling but actually tapping into the oil pipelines. And in the case of Nigeria, again, having the rumor is that there is collaboration by the Navy, which posts ships just off the pipeline and steals the oil from its own government. And that's not the only instance of corruption, and Nigeria's had a record of it. South Africa recently had a scandal on arms purchases. The military was not implicated in this, but clearly it resulted in the firing of the deputy president. And that has got to have an impact on the morale of the military if you have civilian control of the military. So arms purchases, manufacturing, export all have a role to play. The links to civil society within the military are very important. In northern Nigeria, most of the powerful families try to make sure that at least one of their sons go into the armed forces. So that's kind of an insurance policy. If there's a coup, they have a line into the government. And again, as I mentioned before, even though that's not a practice that's necessarily widespread, the role of civil society is pretty small into decisions, except for cases like that where you actually have a family member in it. So what does this mean when we talk about all of these elements in evaluating African capacities? Well, from the U.S. point of view, the two main security interests that the U.S. has in Africa are counterterrorism and peacekeeping, as was mentioned before. And as we've heard, while there is changing norms and a desire to have more capacity, there's a long way to go. As I see it, the U.S. faces three dilemmas, and I'm not sure that they have been explicitly defined. One is the actual conflict or potential conflict between counterterrorism and peacekeeping. I think there is a danger that in pursuit of counterterrorism, we will neglect the human security issues that Africa cares about and knows that is the root of terrorist penetration. So if we do have, and we do have a whole array of policy instruments from GPOI funds for training to development to IMET, all kinds of instruments, we ought to make sure that they're not all focused on counterterrorism traditionally defined, but really address the wider issue of human security issues and peacekeeping. Second, I think that the United States has a tendency to work on a bilateral basis or a unilateral basis, but particularly in Africa has had great disdain for the regional organizations and the sub-regional organizations. That needs to change. because while the norms are changing in Africa, the sense that it has to be done collectively, even if it's a fig leaf, is very well embedded. Africans are not going to want South Africa or Nigeria becoming the local hegemon. So they are going to want to work through ECOWAS and the AU or SADC. And these are institutions that are struggling, as Tori pointed out, have minimal resources. And whatever our strategies and our policies are, they ought to take into account. My feeling is that that's a lag that we have in our foreign policy toward African security issues, that we're dealing on a bilateral basis more than anything else, because it's the easy way. If you have something going with one country, Nigeria, and Nigeria is the heavyweight in ECOWAS, it's a lot easier just to stay on that course than to deal with all the other members. And third and finally, I think we like to deal with elites. And I think if we're really going to address the security issues in Africa, we have to expand our own horizons and make sure that for true security in Nigeria, we have to build institutions, not just to deal with the personalities at the top. And that includes democracy institutions, accountability institutions, professionalism of the military and other institutions, and certainly giving civil society a greater voice in these issues. Thank you.